It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we visit with the author of a new book that traces the history of Jewish people in Wisconsin.
First, Wisconsin's dairy industry has been facing some challenges like the rising cost of inputs and the falling prices of dairy products because of a nationwide surplus.
Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind, a Democrat from La Crosse who represents Wisconsin's 3rd District, recently announced a plan to boost and stabilize the dairy industry in the state. And some of the points of that plan include increasing international trade and reforming the immigration system, given that a large segment of Wisconsin farms depend on immigration labor.
Congressman Kind joins us now. Welcome back to Central Time.
My pleasure.
Well, why do you think Wisconsin needs a dairy plan?
Well, you know, this is June Dairy Month. It's an opportunity for all of us to celebrate and thank our dairy farmers and production agriculture throughout Wisconsin and the economic impact they have on the state, which is tremendous. The dairy industry alone, over $43 billion worth of economic impact, over 79,000 jobs created either directly or indirectly. So it's a large part of our state's economy. But our dairy farmers are struggling. We're looking at pretty low commodity prices. Their profit margins have been squeezed while their fixed costs have gone up. And I think we need a comprehensive strategy in order to do more to provide help and assistance to our dairy farmers through this difficult time so they have an opportunity to succeed and stay in business in Wisconsin.
And you've put together a strategy like that. Could you tell us about the main focal points of your plan?
Yeah, I just introduced the Dairy Action Plan. It's one that builds upon some existing programs to make them more effective, more efficient, more responsive to our dairy farmers and what they need. It also encourages the next generation of dairy farmers to step in and start taking over operations, a New Beginning Farmer program to make that transition easier. The average age of a dairy farmer in Wisconsin is roughly 60 years old, so we do need that next generation to be able to step up and take over. Expanding agricultural research so there's greater value-added products in order to address what the consumers are demanding in the marketplace to increase sales. Expanding market opportunities overseas. Right now we're being shut out entirely in Russia and India, for instance, and that's leading the European Union to dump dairy in the global market, which, is driving down prices for our dairy farmers. We have an opportunity in the Pacific Rim area in particular to expand trade opportunities, to lower tariff barriers to our agriculture products generally, but dairy specifically, and we got to be in that market competing with a level playing field. And then addressing their labor needs, comprehensive immigration reform. We know we have an immigration system that's broke. It needs to be fixed. This is having a huge impact on our dairy farmers throughout Wisconsin. It's long past due for Congress to take action. And these are some of the steps, I think, that will certainly help dairy farmers, but also help production agriculture throughout Wisconsin and the rest of the country.
Well, let's dig into the immigration piece of the puzzle when you're looking at labor and the problem of a labor shortage in the dairy industry. What would you like to see happen to stabilize that resource for Wisconsin dairy farmers?
You know, if I've been back home, I've been visiting a lot of dairy farms, getting feedback from farmers and that. One of the top concerns and challenges they have is a reliable source of labor to help keep their operations efficient and productive. 40% of farm labor now in Wisconsin is immigrant-based, so we've got to recognize that and the huge economic impact it does have, and then fix a system that hasn't been working very well. A lawful entry, agriculture visa programs to help these workers stay on dairy operations like in Wisconsin, and again, listening to the ideas that exist back home and how we can best address it. And what better time than June Dairy Days when you have so many dairy breakfasts going on throughout the state? Again, a chance for us to spend some time on the farm, listen to the farmers, but also appreciate the hard work that they put in and day out.
Now, you've also talked about the expansion of agricultural research through the University of Wisconsin to help dairy farmers. What do you want to do to encourage research like that?
Well, you know, we do have some research programs in the Farm Bill and in other programs at the federal level, but we have been huge beneficiaries of certain research opportunity grants coming into the state. You mentioned UW-Madison, but we've got River Falls, we've got Platteville, we've got Stevens Point, all of whom are doing great campus-based graduate and undergraduate research programs in sustainable agriculture, in alternative fuel development, but also sustainability of production of our agricultural products. And if we do this right, Wisconsin could become the Middle East when it comes to agricultural research, as the Middle East was with oil production. And it's an opportunity that is there for us. We ought to take full advantage. And this, too, can help provide the type of value-added components that our dairy farmers and farmers generally need right now.
How optimistic are you about that at this particular point in time? As you know, the University of Wisconsin system saw $250 million cut from its funding in the budget. So do you think that research you're looking for is going to be viable?
Well, I'm very worried about the direction our state is taking when it comes to support for education generally, but higher education in particular. It took many years for us to develop a superb reputation for higher education, the university system, and right now all that is placed in jeopardy with the draconian cuts that have been made to the higher education budget. It's making it harder to retain and recruit the talent that we need on campus, especially that research talent. And the federal dollars flows to those researchers, not to the institution. So if we lose those researchers off our campuses, if they go to neighboring states or somewhere else in the country, we're going to be losing out on those federal dollars coming into Wisconsin. So I'm calling on Governor Walker and the legislature to reassess their approach to support for higher education and not jeopardize the reputation that took many years for us to build up. Because if we develop a reputation of devaluing higher education, it's going to be a reputation tough to change for many years to come.
Now, to move on to another point, you were talking about trade earlier and opening up markets. You're a supporter of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Not everyone sees it that way, but what would you like to see specifically happen to boost dairy farmer markets in other parts of the world?
Well, you know, the Pacific Rim area, the Asian Trade Agreement, is the fastest-growing area of the global economy. We've got to be in that tent. We've got to be competing there with a level playing field so it's fair for our farmers, for our businesses, for our workers. Otherwise, we're going to be on the outside looking in. And if we fail to move forward on this trade agreement, China will. China's on our heels. They're following our path. They're talking to the same countries and telling them, don't listen to those Americans. They're asking too much of you when it comes to worker rights, environmental standards, human rights standards. Come to us. We don't care about that. And that's the real jeopardy that we face. But under this trade agreement now, we have fully enforceable worker provisions, environmental standards, human rights standards. For instance, I worked hard to include in the agreement a prohibition on the import of products from these countries based on the exploitation of slave labor, forced labor, or child labor. And that's important. And we don't have that tool now, but we would under this agreement. Plus, under the agreement, 18,000 tariff barriers that make it more expensive for us to export products from Wisconsin into these markets go down to zero. It encourages our businesses to stay in Wisconsin so we can make things, grow things, invent things there, and export it into these markets rather than forcing them to have to move there to gain market share. So I encourage people to look at the agreement. It's published. It's on the Internet. It has been for the last 6 months because this is an important discussion that we need to have as a nation, and I think it's important for our state's economy that we get it right.
Now, as we wrap up, as you know, we're in the midst of an election cycle this year, and some of what you were talking about earlier about what you'd like to see for immigration policy in Wisconsin and beyond diverge quite a bit from the platform of prospective Republican nominee Donald Trump. So how would you expect to handle that? Should there be a Trump presidency and a different point of view in the White House?
Well, first of all, I'm praying that there won't be a Trump presidency. I think what he is offering the American people is the wrong direction for us to go in right now. But, you know, we need to have this discussion, and that's what these elections should be about. They're about tomorrow, the future. What do we need to do to improve and expand opportunities for all Americans so we're not leaving anyone behind? Unfortunately, Donald Trump is running a very divisive campaign that's pitting people against people. That's not what we need right now in Wisconsin or throughout our country. And we've known for a long time we've had a broken immigration system. All anyone needs to do is go home and talk to businesses, talk to farmers. They will tell you what's not working. And I hope more of my colleagues, the representatives of this nation, will take more time to listen to people back home. I found there's a lot of common sense, non-political solutions right in Wisconsin if we just learn how to listen and respect each other a little bit more.
Representative Kind, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
That was Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind. He's a Democrat from La Crosse representing Wisconsin's 3rd District. He joined us to talk about his new plan to boost Wisconsin's dairy industry.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, we'll look at the changing landscape of gay and lesbian lives in America and the legal protections our guest says are still missing.
Right now, if you think about Wisconsin's Jewish community, you may think of their presence in larger urban areas like Milwaukee and Madison.
And you'd be right. Jewish leaders, institutions, and families have added a lot to the life and culture in Wisconsin's largest cities.
But in her new book, Jews in Wisconsin, Sheila Turman-Cohen shares not only those stories, but those of Jewish people who have settled throughout the state and over the course of more than two centuries. Sheila, welcome to Central Time.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So, Sheila, when did the first Jewish immigrants come to North America?
They came in the 1600s, and most of them settled on the East Coast.
And when was it that the Jewish settlers started coming further west?
Well, the first Jewish settler to enter Wisconsin was a man by the name of Jacob Franks. He came when Wisconsin really wasn't Wisconsin yet, but rather the Northwest Territory. And it had been a French colony, and because it was a French colony, no Jews were allowed into the territory. French colonies had something called the French Black Law that excluded Jews from entering any French colonies. So after the French Indian War, where the British took control, then Jews were allowed in, and the first brave man that was recorded in history was Jacob Franks, a fur trader who did very, very well. He came from Canada via Britain, settled in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and had a very successful fur trading business with the Native Americans who already were well into fur trading at that time.
So Jacob Franks was the first Jew to settle in the territory that we now call the state of Wisconsin. When did we first see more significant numbers of Jews coming to the state?
Well, there was the first large surge of immigrants from the 1840s to the 1880s, and they came from the German Confederate area. There was a particularly large surge in 1848 when a group of activists calling themselves the 48ers rose up to try and establish a centralized constitutional government. When they failed in their efforts, they were threatened with exile. And as history would have it, coincidentally, that was the very same year that Wisconsin became a state. So the state put ads in European newspapers which said, "Come, in Wisconsin, all men are free and equal before the law. Religious freedom is absolute, and there is not the slightest connection between church and state." And so people did come in droves. And they settled in Milwaukee because it was such an ideal area located on Lake Michigan. The Erie Canal had opened in 1825, and they could send their goods back and forth. The Jewish German immigrants came as merchants. They hadn't really been allowed in professions in Germany, but nevertheless felt every bit the same German pride that their counterparts did, their Gentile counterparts.
So, Sheila, after that initial influx of Jewish immigrants from the 1840s to the 1880s, when was the next wave?
The next wave came in about the 1880s to the 1920s, and in fact, it was the largest wave of immigrants to come from Eastern Europe, mostly the Tsarist-dominated regions of Russia and Poland. Catherine the Great created what was called the Pale of Settlement in 1791, where Jews were to live in small shtetls without very many rights. And in 1882, Alexander II was assassinated, and his son Alexander III blamed the Jews and created what was called pogroms, which were vicious attacks on Jewish villages. So the Jews at that point really had no choice but to try to get out of those areas. And in fact, many did come to Wisconsin. Of course, most of the settlement with the Germans and the Russians was on the East Coast. But quite a few came to Wisconsin as well.
So Milwaukee really did become a hub for Jewish life in Wisconsin. Who were some of those early leaders who built and maintained that community?
Well, three of the most influential families were the Sawyers, the Friends, and the Adlers. And coincidentally, they all came with a needle trade skill and built the clothing manufacturing companies in Milwaukee to be the third largest industry in the city. So they were really quite influential, not only in business, but also they shaped the Reform religious movement in Wisconsin, starting Temple Emmanuel, buying cemetery property, because burying the dead is a very important ritual and rite given to the dead in the Jewish religion.
So it's interesting because I'm sure on some level they were competitors since they were all in the same industry, but it sounds like they really came together in their personal lives and in their religious lives to really foster this community.
Absolutely, they did. They did, yes.
So while Milwaukee and Madison, as the largest metropolitan areas, had and continue to have active and vibrant Jewish communities, you also feature Jews who settled in smaller towns and rural communities. What was the draw for those particular Jewish families to leave the city and settle elsewhere?
Well, it started in about the mid-1800s, when Germans felt that they could probably have less business competition in smaller towns. And as it would have it, the railroad came into the state in 1851. So they weren't as dependent on steamship travel to carry their goods back and forth. So they did go to small towns, Sheboygan, Stevens Point, Superior, La Crosse, Green Bay, and they became very successful. Many of them ran for public office, and five cities elected mayors. They also, believe it or not, had some sports heroes. Two of them were Isidore and Nathan Abrams. And as the story goes, they gave $3,000 to Curly Lambeau to start the Packers.
Really?
And then both of them played on the Packers. There was somebody else by the name of Maury Arnovich, who lived in Superior, Wisconsin, who became a star outfielder for the Philadelphia Phillies, the Cincinnati Reds, and the New York Giants. When he was done with his sports career, he went back to Superior and became president of their synagogue. So unknown facts about Jews in Wisconsin.
So it is interesting because we're seeing a lot of discussion about influxes of migrants and immigrants around the world right now. It sounds like the Jewish immigrants who moved to those smaller towns where they were not part of a large Jewish community necessarily, at least in the beginning, but really, you know, maybe one or two families in a mostly Christian community. It sounds like they struck some way of really becoming not just part of the community, but really integral parts of the communities.
They certainly did, yes. And I feel that was very much a part of a welcoming spirit, for the most part, in Wisconsin. Of course, there were periods of anti-Semitism, which reflected the national tenor of the time. There were resorts that were restricted, neighborhoods that were restricted, quota systems in the universities, although I have to say the University of Wisconsin was an exception to that rule due to Bob La Follette's idea of wanting to have a very diverse student body. And so, in fact, people even from the East Coast flocked to the University of Wisconsin, and it was there that the second Hillel chapter, a Jewish chapter of Hillel, started in 1924. So Wisconsin had some very good things about it for Jewish settlers.
And just as we wrap up, Sheila, both world wars saw many refugees leaving Europe, coming to the United States and other countries, and certainly a lot of Jewish refugees coming in. What have been the more recent Jewish immigrants coming to Wisconsin? Where have they been from?
Well, the most recent, I don't know if you call this recent, but of course the Holocaust survivors in the 40s. And then after that, Soviet Jews who were called refuseniks. They had tried to leave the country many times and couldn't. And finally things loosened up in the Soviet Union and they were allowed to come here. And many Wisconsin families welcomed them, sponsored them, and they too have fit into the community. That was probably in around the 1970s and 1980s.
Sheila, you have some book events coming up. Where will you be?
I do have events. One is this evening, as a matter of fact, at the Milwaukee Jewish Museum from 7 to 9 o'clock tonight. Another one is the Levy Summer Series on Thursday, July 7th in Madison at the Nakoma Country Club, and that would be at about 11:30 a.m. It's a luncheon, and I would be speaking at 11:30, followed by lunch. And the following one is at the Wisconsin Historical Society Museum on Tuesday, July 12th at noon.
Well, Sheila, thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you.
Sheila Turman-Cohen is the author of several Badger biographies. Her most recent book is Jews in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll learn about the steps the state wants to take to address issues surrounding Alzheimer's and dementia.
First, when the Supreme Court ruled in favor of legalized same-sex marriage in 2015, it was a major victory for gay and lesbian rights in the United States. And public support for same-sex marriage is at an all-time high. The latest polling from the Pew Research Center finds that more than half of Americans support same-sex unions.
Well, our next guest acknowledges that we live in an era of considerable advancement and change for LGBT rights. He says that gay, lesbian, and transgender citizens are still too often considered less than whole and are still lacking full legal protections against workplace, housing, family, and other kinds of discrimination. And as we saw in the wake of the mass shooting at a gay club in Orlando this past weekend, there's still anti-gay prejudice to be found in the United States.
Stephen Engel joins us now. He's associate professor and chair of politics at Bates College. He's also an affiliated scholar at the American Bar Foundation. His new book is Fragmented Citizens, The Changing Landscape of Gay and Lesbian Lives. Stephen, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
So let's go back to early 2015. Public support for same-sex marriage was at a record high, more and more states legalizing it, and the Supreme Court was getting ready to have the final say. Yet, as you say, it was still a disorienting season for gays and lesbians in the United States. What else was happening around that time that spoke to this idea of less than whole citizenship?
Well, I think, you know, on the eve of the Obergefell decision, which, of course, was that decision that declared bans on same-sex marriage unconstitutional, you have, and I use a vignette to open the book, about tax season, right? And so when you're filing your taxes as a same-sex couple, prior to Obergefell, in some states you are recognized as married. In some states, that might carry forward for the federal recognition, but in other states that would not be the case. Or, for example, if you celebrated your wedding in a state, the federal government that recognized it, the federal government would recognize it, but that might leave some others out. And so you had to file multiple types of tax returns. And so the state would essentially render your relationship apart in the tax filing. There were some other issues going on. This was about the same time that there were some Religious Freedom Restoration Acts that were coming down the pipe in Arizona and then later in Indiana that were attempting to curb recognitions of LGBT equality in favor of First Amendment rights of religious expression. And so you had this tension between equality that followed from the 14th Amendment versus religious expression that might follow from the First Amendment. And then, of course, that gets tangled up in a lot of discourse about the ways in which companies and firms would either bring business into a state or not, depending on what their approach to LGBT equality was. And so I think it was disorienting for all of these reasons. In part, I think, even after Obergefell, the status of gays and lesbian citizens is disorienting, and this is the theme I explore in the book, precisely because it is contingent on the governing issue in which you as a citizen are interacting, so and on the issue. So, for example, if I were married, that relationship might be recognized by the federal government or by the state, but I might live in a state that doesn't recognize my status to, say, equal employment or equality in public accommodations. And so depending on the policy issue, the status of my citizenship, of my equality, is rendered unequal or fragmented.
So you've touched on a few of those, but let's look more closely at some of those big areas where inequalities and legal discrimination are still present. So you mentioned the workplace. What are some of the issues for gay and lesbian people in the workplace and having workplace protections?
Right, certainly. Well, there is, in fact, no ban on discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity in terms of workplace discrimination in over 25 states. There's also no ban on discrimination in public accommodations on gender identity or sexual orientation in over 25 states. Now, this has actually been a very interesting moment. What I mean by that is that there is, in fact, no law, federal law, that, like, say, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, that includes sexual orientation or gender identity as a specific category that is protected from discrimination. So if you were to look at the 1964 Civil Rights Act, it mentions things like race, sex, color, creed, etc., and sexual orientation as a phrase is not in there. More recently, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has ruled that sexual orientation and gender identity might be covered under the concept of sex. This has been a concept that legal theorists have played with for over 20 years, that, for example, sex discrimination or sexual orientation discrimination, to take one example, is actually a version of sex discrimination. Because what we're saying when we're discriminating against someone who is gay or lesbian, we're saying that that person, precisely because they have romantic feelings for someone of the same sex, is violating a sex stereotype. Mm. And violations of sex stereotypes are, in fact, a form of sex discrimination or you know, not conforming. The expectation that one conform to a sex stereotype is a form of sex discrimination.
Another aspect that you address in the book, and you kind of touched on it in an interesting way with tax returns. So one of the things that people often do on a tax return is claim a dependent, a child, and adoption, and also being able to have two same-sex parents listed on a birth certificate, for example, and all the rights that come with that. That is also something that is not guaranteed for same-sex couples.
Oh, yes. I mean, the status of second-parent adoption or step-parent adoption for same-sex couples, it very much varies by state. There have been some definitive laws that said, you know, bans on same-sex adoptions, and in most cases, those absolute bans have most recently been struck down. But it still does leave the status of same-sex parents, whether two parents of the same sex can be listed on the birth certificate, is still a very gray area, and it does depend in the jurisdiction state by state. So to make this sort of like a very real situation, I have a very good friend who went on the academic job market a few years ago, and he and his husband, and they have two children, and they were restricted in their job search after graduate school. So they could only go to certain states where their status as parents, that they were both equally recognized as fathers, that they would have employment discriminations if they had a job at a public institution, that they could make sure that benefits would match up with the partner status. This differs state by state, and so it affected their abilities to, you know, go on the job market fully.
We're talking with Stephen Engel. He's associate professor and chair of politics at Bates College, and his new book is Fragmented Citizens: The Changing Landscape of Gay and Lesbian Lives. Now, there are, in several of those topics that we just covered, there is the issue of what is a federal right, what has been granted by certain states, and there are some people that will say this is an issue of states' rights versus federal rights. How would you address that?
Well, I do think that there is a claim, a historical claim, where there, you know, that states' rights is certainly something that we value, because what we're saying is there's a principle in our Constitution of federalism. There are conflicting principles with federalism that are also in our Constitution. The guarantees of equal protection and due process and privileges and immunities of citizenship that follow from the 14th Amendment, I think, are just as strong. And so we have to come up with a way in which what is the balance between those two principles, or in fact, what do we value more? Do we value the way in which states can make decisions, or do we value the notion that if you are a citizen of the United States, then you are guaranteed certain fundamental equal rights as all other citizens of the United States? Taking, as a constitutional law professor at Bates, I take a historical view towards this, and I would argue that the 14th Amendment, coming on the heels of the Civil War, radically transformed the meaning of the Constitution. That if you look at the Bill of Rights, for example, the first 10 amendments, the target of those 10 amendments was really restricting Congress. It was restricting the federal power in favor of the state power. After the Civil War, we see a reversal where we are actually restricting state power in favor and empowering the federal government to protect citizens directly. And I think as a sort of a developmental moment, we have to think about whether or not we've come to a place where citizenship and equal citizenship is perhaps a more valuable principle than states' rights, especially if those states' rights have been used historically as cover for what we would now consider to be discriminatory action.
So we are about a year out from that landmark Supreme Court decision saying that same-sex marriage is legal in the United States. According to the American Civil Liberties Union, in that past year, since then, more anti-LGBTQ bills have been introduced than in any other year in recent history. They count at least 140 state bills introduced across the country, and they anticipate even more next year. This is all while public opinion continues to shift towards greater acceptance. Is there an easy answer for why that is?
Well, I don't think there is an easy answer. I mean, I think that's exactly what I'm trying to explore in the book. I think we tend to view that dynamic of, say, a social movement win, like the Obergefell decision, and then we see a kind of pushback, a politics of counter-movement mobilization. So we might include in those, you know, the past year of legislation, the RFRAs, the Religious Freedom Restoration Acts, or something like HB2 out of North Carolina. And I think that while there's something true to that, this is a kind of a social movement and then a kind of counter movement pushback, I think what we're also seeing is that political change in the United States is always partial. So altering laws in one domain raises to the surface tensions with laws and policies in another domain, right? So you have a sort of shift in marriage. And what that suggests is, you know, raises to the surface new inequalities, or it highlights, brings to the fore new inequalities. People stake their positions out on maintaining or trying to dislodge those new inequalities, like what I was saying earlier, this tension that we now perceive between religious expression and a claim towards equal rights. You know, the canonical case of the wedding cake baker who doesn't want to feel compelled to provide a wedding cake for a same-sex marriage.
We're talking right now with Stephen Engel, author of Fractured Citizens, about the changing landscape of gay and lesbian lives in America and the legal protections he says they still lack.
And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. What's next for the LGBT movement in America? Do you see legalized discrimination against gay and lesbian citizens? And do you think there are changes that need to be made? Call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking right now with Stephen Engel, professor and chair of politics at Bates College and author of the book Fragmented Citizens. And we're looking at the challenges faced by LGBT Americans and what hurdles to full equal citizenship, he says, still remain.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What direction do you see the LGBT movement taking next? Do you see legalized discrimination against gay and lesbian citizens at the state or federal level? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And actually, Stephen, we do have a caller on the line. Gary in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Gary.
Hi there. Interesting show. It seems to me that so many gains have been made so fast, and you know, I never hear any gratitude at all, like, thanks, America. I mean, you know, like, we've done a lot here for the LGBTQ plus movement, more than probably any other country, or at least we're doing our best, you know, and it's like, holy cow, you know, marriage has been changed, and that's a jarring thing to a lot of people. Changing the definition of marriage was a big deal. And, you know, so there have been a lot of gains. Will there be pushback? Of course there'll be pushback. I mean, until everyone's silent and nods in agreement and hugs everybody, is that what we need to do? This is America. We're going to have differing views, and I think gay, lesbian, you know, queer, all that stuff have made a lot of gains. So I don't hear any gratitude ever, though. Never. It's always grievances.
All right. Thanks for that call, Gary. And Stephen, how would you respond to that comment?
Well, I think Gary is right that there has been a fair bit of change, but I would question whether or not the change is coming at a pace that is you know, lightning fast, in the sense that we think about the marriage debate as kind of, you know, a really radical shift, say, in the last 10 years, you know, if we say starting with the Massachusetts decision in 2004 and then Obergefell in 2015, you know, in the span of a decade, that is a pretty radical shift. But I would suggest that, you know, from a historical perspective, the fight for marriage, if we just take that one right, that actually stretches back significantly, at least into beginning in the mid 20th century. So these are not spans of movement mobilization. The LGBT movement has been pushing for equal rights and equal recognitions for quite some time. And I question whether the claim is that the LGBT, those of us who identify as LGBT, should somehow be grateful to the rest of the community for acknowledging that we are, in fact, part of the community. We are citizens. We participate with rights and responsibilities that accord to citizens, and so it is only fair that we are recognized as such. And it is the case, as I pointed out earlier, that equal recognition is not fully there. And I think, in particularly in light of this past weekend shootings in Orlando, I think we're at a very sort of painful and sobering moment in LGBT rights progress. I think what has been revealed is the highly contingent status of what many thought was a steady trend towards equal and dignified recognition. And what Orlando, I think, calls us to reassess both what forward motion should look like for the LGBT movement as we push forward, but it also, I think, reminds us that rights struggles don't necessarily happen in a kind of singular forward or progressive momentum, that in fact, there is a lot of pushback, as the caller suggested, and that these are sort of long hauls. You know, despite the rhetoric of the arc of history bends towards justice, that's not necessarily the case. There's a long history in the United States of you know, the passage, say, for example, of the 14th Amendment, and then 100 years of history where we simply ignore that amendment.
I want to touch on Orlando again, but I also want to bring Mary from Milwaukee in the conversation now. Hi, Mary.
Hello. Well, I just want to comment to your last caller that said the LGBT community should be saying thank you. Why? They have the same rights that the rest of us do. I just don't understand that. And I don't think we're progressing in this area anymore. I think we're taking big, huge steps backwards. And I just am appalled.
Well, thank you for that call, Mary. And I think what we see with Mary and Gary both expressing their opinion, Stephen, is that there is still a lot of disagreement and discussion about these topics.
Well, I definitely think that that is true. And I think when we ask whether or not there is progress in this area, I would suggest that, I mean, one of the reasons I wrote the book was I think that no one could deny, and if we bracket the violence in Orlando to one side for a moment, I think no one could deny that there's a particular subset of gay or lesbian individuals, cisgender, white, those with financial means, that the sense of equal treatment under the law has greatly improved for those individuals over the last two decades. But I wonder, you know, and I think we have to think very clearly about what about those in our community who are not cisgender? What about those who are not of a particular financial status or have financial means? What about those queers of color? And what is their level of equality, of their level of equal treatment? I think when we think about what is the next push for the LGBT movement, I think it's quite true that there has been some progress, particularly for particular kinds of gay and lesbian citizens, but a lot more remains ahead.
And just as we prepare to wrap up, in light of that shooting in Orlando, the victims were predominantly gay people of color.
Mm-hmm.
There have been some calls to not use the tragedy for political ends, but others say that everything else in the lives of LGBTQ people gets politicized, so why not something like Orlando? How would you respond to those two positions?
I think that's a very delicate topic. I want to be extraordinarily respectful to the families, the friends, the victims of this horrific shooting. At the same time, I do think that something very valuable can come out of that moment by making a political statement, by saying that maybe it is time once again that pride celebrations that occur throughout this month of June take on a little bit more of a political stand, that, you know, in what we thought was a moment of great celebration because of marriage, for example, the one-year anniversary, that what Orlando demonstrated was that there's so much left to be done, and that maybe it is time to think about pride celebrations as less of commercialized parades and more as political protest movements.
Well, Stephen, thank you so much for joining us today. It was a very interesting and informative discussion.
Thank you. I had a pleasure.
That was Stephen Engel, associate professor and chair of politics at Bates College. He's also an affiliated scholar of the American Bar Foundation. His new book is Fragmented Citizens: The Changing Landscape of Gay and Lesbian Lives.
A week or so ago, we did an interview about the ongoing design contest for a new Milwaukee flag.
The official flag of Milwaukee was called out by a designer and podcaster during a TED talk. He called it a hot mess and one of the worst in the country.
So a Milwaukee designer named Stephen Kotis decided to get the people of Milwaukee involved and launched a design competition for a new flag. And the winning flag was just announced this week. You can take a look at it over on the Central Time Facebook page.
The new flag is blue with a sun setting on Lake Michigan. It has three bars in the lake reflection to symbolize the city's three rivers and founding town. Yes, there's also yellow to represent Milwaukee's beer brewing history.
So the new one, it's much simpler.
Yes.
It doesn't have, if you do look at the current official Milwaukee flag, it's got a lot of nice imagery, but there's a lot of it.
There's a lot going on. In fact, in the Central Time office, someone thought that the current flag was actually a compilation of all of the the competition designs, because it does. It looks like a big montage, kind of.
It does have that impression. So the new one, you know, it's sort of more graphic design friendly. It would look good on, for instance, a T-shirt.
Yes, or a mug or a tote bag.
And I think they have some of this merchandising available. But as we know, we don't know if it will be the new official flag. That's up to the Milwaukee Common Council.
But if you were wondering if anyone cares about flags, the answer is a resounding yes.
Keep listening. There's more to come here on Central Time.